What I'd like to talk about is the Four Noble Truths in relationship to relationship. And I'm going to just talk for a while until I run out and then ask for questions and see what's on your mind. As you probably know, the Four Noble Truths are the truth, include the truth of unsatisfactoriness or suffering, discontent, otherwise known by the Pali term dukkha. And I'll probably use the word dukkha as we go on because I like the word and it comes out of my mouth more easily than any other word. So the first noble truth is dukkha. The second noble truth is the cause or the reasons for dukkha, which already makes one a little bit happy because it's not like there's just one noble truth and it's dukkha and that's it. Which I don't know what we'd do if that were true. We certainly wouldn't be here. But looking at the reasons or causes for dukkha. And the third, which of course makes us very, very happy, which is the end of dukkha, you know, cessation of dukkha. As some of you know, Buddhism has gotten somewhat of a bad press at times because people only talk about the first, which is really bad because it really is only the first. And the third is really why we practice cessation, you know, peace. The Buddha said, I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. So the second part of this is really quite crucial. And then the fourth noble truth is the path, is that there is actually a path that we can practice. And this is enormously encouraging as well. You know, because just to see the cause and just to know that cessation does exist is a good thing, but it's not enough. To have a path of practice, to know how to practice, is probably the most profound thing. You know, to know that we can be on a path and that this path becomes ever more visible and available and accessible to us with each moment that we remember that we're on a path. So the first noble truth being dukkha, I've always found interesting because you could say that, you know, the Buddha said that there is dukkha, that there is discontent, there is suffering. And it's easy for us, if we live even a little bit of life, to see that this is true, you know, to acknowledge that things are oftentimes difficult in life, that there is insecurity, there is anxiety. Things oftentimes don't go the way we want them to go. But it's very interesting if you look at the classical definition of dukkha, because it has everything to do with other people. One of the classical definitions of dukkha is that we are bound to those whom we would prefer not to be bound to. So you can look at your work environment, maybe. You know, sometimes people in one's family wouldn't particularly choose to have some particular people in one's family. We're bound to people that we don't want to be bound to. And we don't have contact with people that we do want to have contact with. And this is so interesting to me because this has everything to do with other people. You know, it's kind of I think expressing the place of people in our life, that there is so much potential joy in relationship, and there really indeed is, as we know. And at the same time, it's where so much of our angst and our difficulty comes from. You know, in interviews, in individual interviews, so much of what is spoken about has to do with people. I would say it's maybe 90%. I don't know, I might be a little bit exaggerating there, but it's a lot. It's a lot in terms of looking at relationship with others. The word dukkha, of course, does mean discontentment or unsatisfactoriness of things, or sometimes the word suffering is used. But there's another phrase that I think is very, very handy and helpful for right now, which is that which is incapable of satisfying. That which is incapable of satisfying. Now, this does not mean that on the relative level, relationship can't be enormously nourishing and joyful and happiness producing. You know? So it's not to have a dire kind of approach to this. But incapable of satisfying in the way that the Buddha was speaking about it means incapable of ultimate lasting satisfaction. You know? So we can see that a big part of this, of course, is that people are out of our control. How people act and behave and what they say and what they believe and what they think is completely out of our control. Plus, if you can get somebody to completely be on your same page for a moment or two every 10 years, it's going to change. It is going to change because everybody changes. We change. All our cells are changing. Yeah? So why wouldn't this be true for everybody else in this world? Everything is always changing. And then, even if you're in the best possible, wonderful, incredible relationship, of course, there we are going to lose it at some point because of death. So incapable of ultimate satisfaction is what this means. If we can look at our unrealistic expectations, and you could say our unrealistic expectations in the realm of relationship have to do with burdening the conditions of phenomena with our unrealistic expectations. In other words, I'm a phenomena, you're a conditioned phenomena, we're all conditioned phenomena. And burdening ourselves and burdening those around us with the unrealistic expectation that they should be ultimately satisfying, that they should offer lasting peace or happiness or satisfaction. It's the dream in America. It might be in the world, you know, that to find the right person or to have the perfect child, you know, or to have the ideal mother, or, of course, you know, the exact dream partner or spouse is going to be it. And yet, when one actually experiences that in one's life, if that is one's karma, and one actually does find exactly the right person to be with, or you know, it's the right person to be with, that's sometimes where the recognition of dukkha is really learned. Because you found it, you know? It's nirvana from a Hollywood point of view. You know, you've reached it. It's enlightenment. And yet, of course, it isn't. And the reason that it isn't, a couple of reasons that it isn't, but one reason is because no one can take our bad feelings away from us. Now, of course, we can be helped by others. We can be supported by our beloveds. We can be certainly nourished. You know, there's so many wonderful things. It's a wonderful grace to be with really, really people that where there's a simpatico and a real, you know, a wholesomeness about it. But even in that kind of situation, that kind of, you know, as perfect as it can be kind of situation, it's still that person cannot take away our bad feelings. Maybe for a moment. Maybe there can be some degree of comfort and they can be alleviated to some degree for some amount of time. But they come back. You know, those bad feelings, those difficult feelings of whatever they might be, of grief and of alienation and of impatience and of anger and of this and that, they still come back because this is really where our work lies and is not something that we can hand over to another person. The other thing, of course, that happens when or if one finds the right person to be with is that, and I'm working with a number of people right now in Cambridge around kind of what you could call this life koan or life area of investigation, which is that it's going to change. In other words, the fear of the person leaving you, and maybe not leaving you because of being separated from you, but because of death. And it's a very profound question. Can I survive when my beloved is gone? And a number of people are working with this. So this is the dukkha of having found a really good relationship. This is the other side of things. There's the yearning, the craving, the wanting of it, the perfect spouse, the perfect partner, the perfect father, the perfect mother, the perfect child, the perfect friend. And then you get it, and there's more dukkha. So you're wondering why I'm smiling, but we do move on from here. I just wanted to paint an appropriate picture. It's very important to recognize that this is not a personal problem that one has. Because sometimes when there is a really lovely connection or a wonderful simpatico, or when one really does feel met by another human being, and it's so good, and then it's not what it's cracked up to be. It's wonderful, it's so good, but it's not what it's been cracked up to be. Then one can think that it's a personal problem. It's my problem because I should be more grateful, or I should be happier. Or, of course, that's when people tend to drop people in their life because that other person isn't living up to one's expectations. So I think this is a wonderful thing to keep in mind, because if you see it as the first noble truth, you're likely to have a little bit more mercy with yourself as well as the person who is the focus of all of one's hopes for ultimate relief, which is a huge burden for that other person to be taking on. To put it mildly, nobody can live up to that burden. Everything collapses under that kind of a burden. So if we can see it as this is the first noble truth, then it's a noble truth. It's not a personal difficulty or a personal problem, or that you're neurotic. We all are neurotic, but it doesn't mean that one's neurotic. It means that we're just simply not recognizing that it's the first noble truth of dukkha. The Buddha spoke about this 2,500 years ago. And, of course, he didn't make it up. He discovered this truth. He didn't create this truth. So you could say it's really kind of a beginningless truth. We were talking in one of the groups, in the group today, about ignorance being beginningless. But noble truths are beginningless, too. So this has always been so, that conditioned phenomena. And as I say, I'm a conditioned phenomena, you're a conditioned phenomena, all beings are conditioned phenomena, meaning that we arise and pass away, our bodies and our minds do not last, and ultimate happiness, the happiness of the heart that can last, it's very, very different than the temporary situation that we find ourselves in. If we can see it as dukkha is happening right now, it can, in and of itself, we don't even have to move on to the other truths. This one truth can bring about some degree of perspective, some degree of wisdom, and indeed, some degree of relief. Dukkha is happening right now instead of I'm a mess and you're a mess. Discontent is occurring. This is how things are. And then we can move into looking at the cause. But it has to be acknowledged before we can move on. We can't skip steps here. And if we don't know that this is dukkha, if we see it as a personal problem, then it's very difficult to take the next step and to inquire into the conditions that are supporting dukkha, the cause or the reasons why dukkha is occurring. So this honesty, this acknowledgement, requires quite a bit of awareness, because our conditioning is so strong in terms of taking things personally and thinking that it's my personal problem, or, of course, it's your personal problem, and I would be just fine if you didn't have this personal problem of not, helping me from moment to moment by being perfect, even if I'm not. So acknowledging, recognizing, dukkha is happening right here and now. And depending on who you're with, You know, because I know there's a mother and daughter in this room, and I know that there's some partners practicing together, depending on who you're, or just Dharma sisters and brothers. To acknowledge it with one another can be somewhat helpful, too. I mean, of course, you can't go around with people at work or people you don't know talking about dukkha. But with people that you feel close to and where there's trust and in a Dharma community, that can be acknowledged. Yeah, that in personal things that we get into, dukkha is happening right now. You know, just that simple recognition. And then moving into looking and investigating the reasons, the cause, what supports dukkha continuing to happen. And this is a really interesting arena. This is where we can really kind of get in there and look more deeply. Da da da! I feel like there should be a drum roll with the reasons why. The reason why really basically comes down to attachment. And really what you could say in the realm of relationship is it's attachment to agendas and expectations. Yeah. Attachment to agendas and expectations about how I should be with you and very much about how you should be with me. And we really need to look at both sides of this. You know, how I should be with you, how I should always be from moment to moment loving and caring and patient. You know, even though my experience is quite different than that. You know? And I'm not at all saying that these aren't good aspirations and happiness producing aspirations. You know, to have the aspiration to know love in one's life and to encourage patience. Now, this is very beautiful, and this helps us a lot to have this kind of an aspiration. But if we are idealistic about it, where I must be loving right now, even though I'm experiencing rage, you know, I have to be in this particular way. I should be able to let go right now, even though I'm experiencing grasping. And I'm experiencing irritation, you know, or impatience, then we really cut short our practice in that moment. It's really being with things as they are instead of things as they should be. And this is really a guide for us in practice. How are things right now? Because then we can move into a different place. That can really be a bridge into actually embodying our aspirations to know love in our hearts and to be more patient. You know? But we really need to be with the actuality of what is happening, because that's how we move into transformation. The should really slows us down and blocks honesty from happening, blocks mindfulness from happening, because if things are not the way they are, if I am not living up to my expectations of myself, then, you know, my mind has to move somewhere. It has to find refuge somewhere. And it usually does not find refuge anywhere good, you know? Most of the time, it does not find refuge where refuge really can be found. We can also see that our expectations on our agendas about others really control us, really keep us locked into dukkha. And really, whenever we see that we're irritated or upset with someone, or something is not the way we want it to be, and I'm not talking about the joy of disagreeing, which we do all the time, I'm talking about when there's something genuinely wrong, you know, even just for a moment, when there's something genuinely clenched up in one's heart, you know, what we may need to do at that point is to apply this second noble truth and look at what agendas and expectations we may be attached to, you know, to just see if we can be as honest as possible. What do I want right now? What do I wish this person would say to me? How do I want this person to be with me? Now remember that the expectations and the agendas themselves are not a problem. It's the attachment. Because we can have extremely reasonable agendas and expectations for others. We can have the very reasonable and wholesome expectation that we be treated with respect. You know, and may all beings in this world be treated with respect, right? No, this is a reasonable and wholesome expectation. We can have the expectation or the agenda that people not lie to us, that people be honest with us. You know, this is reasonable and wholesome. And of course, we don't want to be too much around people who are not treating us with respect and being dishonest. But the point I'm trying to make is that whether it's a reasonable expectation or not, it's not always going to be offered. You know? And we're really stuck if we are attached to other people being a certain way. There's no way that we can move. There's no flexibility. There's no fluidity because our mind is glommed onto. It's almost like tunnel vision, you know, glommed onto. This has to be a certain way. I have to be treated in this particular way, even if it's, you know, with the dry cleaners where it really doesn't matter. You know, I have to be treated. I have to be approached in this particular way. And we have no room around us when we are caught in this way. And again, I want to say, it's not the agendas and expectations themselves, which can be quite reasonable. It's the attachment. It's that things have to be a certain way. It's that I can't be happy. I can't be peaceful myself unless you're treating me in this particular way. And in this way, we're completely beholden to others. You know, completely lost in the capriciousness of others' emotions and impulses. And we know what ours are like. You know, they change all the time. They are not reliable. So to hand ourselves over to others' emotions, it's absolutely a recipe for pain and disaster. You know, on a small level sometimes, very subtle level, sometimes on really strong levels. You know, it absolutely doesn't work. We might want to look, though, at our unreasonable agendas and expectations. You know, we might want to look at that because we have a number of them. Some of our unreasonable expectations and agendas are to be constantly reassured by others that we're okay. That's unreasonable. It's unreasonable to want to always be approved of, whatever our behavior may be like. Yeah. Sometimes that's what we're asking of from others, that we want to be unconditionally approved of, whatever our behavior is like. It doesn't work that way. You know, we're not going to be. We can want to be better than others. That can be an agenda and an expectation that we can have. And it causes such a strong degree of inner clenching and tension to want to be better. And we can sometimes even see in our meditation practice, because that's something that all of us in this room really value. We always want to be better at what we value. You know, we don't really care in arenas where we don't value it. But if we value something, that's where the ego gets involved. So here we value meditation. We value being awake and aware. And so I want to be more awake than you. I want to be more aware than you. I want to be the most loving meditator possible. I mean, it'd be a very lonely place to be if I'm more loving than you and you're not loving. It would really be a drag. It's not really a very, you know, happiness-producing aspiration. But we can get really quite caught up in this wanting to be better than in the arenas that we value in life. And it really is quite an unhappiness-producing agenda that we want to notice. The moments when we're competing or comparing with others. We also sometimes have this very funny agenda or expectation that other people should entertain us. Yeah? It's really funny. We can be with someone and think, oh, they're so boring. You know? What's the problem here? It's our mind in that moment that we're bored with. You know, that person has no... Their place in life is not to entertain us. Their place in life is actually not to be charming. Their place in life is to be themselves, just as our place in life is to be ourselves. Yeah? So wanting others to be charming and entertaining is sometimes an agenda that we carry around. And we can see if we have this agenda when we find ourselves in contact with someone that we're perceiving as uninteresting. How can any human being in this world, if we look deeply enough, be uninteresting? Yeah? I mean, it doesn't make any sense since all of us have Buddha nature. You know, what's uninteresting? You know, it's a lack of aliveness in ourselves when we get caught in this kind of boredom. We can see that when we are caught up in our attachments to things needing to be a certain way, to our agendas and to our expectations, that we've lost our intelligence, we've lost our creativity, our options are closed. There's nothing unexpected that can happen because we want something to be a certain way. Actually, we don't even usually just want it. It has to be a certain way. And then when it's not that way, we experience discouragement or anxiety or rage or resignation or irritation. You know? And that's like a hint to us that we're attached. That's like feedback, helpful feedback, helpful hint that something's going on that we have to pay attention to within ourselves. And we find ourselves quite lost in our reactivity and in our conditioning. We can as well divide people up into this world. We can divide people up into whether we think that they're going to help us or even save us, or whether they're going to be problems for us. And a lot of this is unconscious. We just have kind of vague perceptions. So it's something that we perhaps would want to take up as a practice in contact with whomever we're with, not just people that we know well or feel good about or don't feel good about or, you know, kind of already know the terrain with. But with everybody that we come in contact with, we can bring in a subtlety of awareness, of mindfulness, to see whether we're dividing people up in some way. How can you be of use to me? You know, and then if you're not, then dismissed. You know? And then avoiding or overtly, antagonistically engaging with people who are problems. And then trying to move towards or get more of or grasp onto or cling to people that we think can do something for us or can even save us, which can be a kind of a hidden desire in there. We can also see and notice our attachment to our perceptions being pinning people down, as in, I know you are like this or you are like that. I know. You know? And really it's our conditioning that knows. It's not that we know. But pinning people down and labeling them in a certain way, in the same way that we label ourselves. I am like this. I am this kind of a person. Rodney was talking about image before, earlier today. Yeah? We do that with others as well. We immediately see someone, and then because of all sorts of reasons having to do with our history and our memory and our conditioning, we think you are like this or you are like that. And then case closed. You know, we don't look more deeply. And of course, love is cut off when we don't look more deeply. Our views and our opinions, when we're attached to them, leave us quite prejudiced and biased. And we lose our freshness. We lose our innocence. We lose our beginner's mind. You know, that heart or that mind that can approach every being that we come in contact with an awareness of their inner vitality, their inner aliveness. One helpful way to practice in being aware of the causes and conditions for the arising of dukkha is to notice our focusing on the object. And what I mean by the object right now is the other person, you know, or the seeming source of our unhappiness or irritation or anxiety. And instead, removing our attention from the source, the seeming source, and instead taking a greater degree of interest in our own reactivity. No, and it actually, as we practice this, as many of you know, we do develop a greater degree of interest in our own reactivity. So instead of being so interested in the other person, we can be interested in what is arising within us. And in relationship to ourselves, it's the same thing. You know, with the thoughts and the emotions, instead of focusing on the object, instead of focusing on where the suffering seems to be coming from, we can instead remove our attention from the seeming source and place it on the reactivity to the source, to the object. And that's where the life comes in. It's really kind of where the exit sign can be seen, you know, is bringing our attention to an interest in the reactivity that's occurring. You can kind of like, you know, in sensing this, that's where the aliveness is. Life comes again instead of being flattened or narrowed or this sense of tunnel vision. The options and the creativity begins to open because we're actually focusing somewhere where dukkha can dissolve, you know, where it's not a message of being condemned for our whole entire life, but that we really can move into what is called the Third Noble Truth. The Third Noble Truth, of course, is cessation of dukkha or peace. You know? So peace in relationship, cessation of suffering with other people in this world, in the relationship itself, whichever relationship it may be. And really this is an absence of contraction. It's an absence of the heart being gripped by the tension and the contraction that we may usually feel, and may feel even in a very low way, kind of like a low-grade fever of anxiety or a low-grade fever of fear or something like that. You know, the cessation, in looking at our reaction, this brings us into cessation. And then there is a greater degree of ease and real joy. You know, because we're not depending on that person to be the way we want them to be. We're freeing that person up. We're freeing everybody up to be how they want to be. And in that, there is really the touching and the arising, really, of deep joy and deep appreciation for the contact that we get with others. In this, there is a patience and a relaxation and a greater degree of acceptance. When there is a small moment of cessation, you know, just a little moment of sensation, it's a moment of seeing through the contraction and letting it go, you know, or allowing it to let go of us, which is more the reality of things, you know. Allowing it to be seen, allowing ourselves to be aware of it, and then in just that one moment, a dropping away and the experiencing of a greater degree of ease and of peace. When it's more sustained, which comes about through practicing this and seeing this and applying wisdom in our life of relationships, you know, then when it is more sustained, then there is actually, of course, less tension, less inner tension with other people in a sustained kind of way. You know, there's more of, I would call it fun, actually. Yeah? Even when there are differences in life, yeah? Even in the midst of us all not agreeing, which is never going to happen in this world. Now, even in the midst of this, there is a joy or maybe a fun in the interaction itself. Some of this, of course, comes about through not focusing as strongly as we do on the faults of others. You know, not focusing only on that. And it's not to not see, because we always want our wisdom and our discernment to be operating. So it's not to not see what's happening. And it's so tempting to latch onto and focus on and forget the biggerness of life, to forget that each one of us, everybody we come in contact with, has Buddha nature. Not only I have Buddha nature, but all beings have Buddha nature. And in this practice, we practice this practice of wisdom in relationship, we practice not just seeing our own Buddha nature and having more confidence in it, which is really essential and important, but we also try to come to everybody we come in contact with this same perspective. And we begin to notice the people that we forgive for their faults, you know, or accept their faults or don't have a problem with their faults, and the people that we latch onto and see and think this is all they are, instead of the faults being an aspect of reality just as it is for us, our torments of heart being an aspect of life instead of the entirety of life. And so we are aware of both. And in this freedom from attachment, meaning that we're not basing our happiness on conditions, there is a greater sense of connectedness and of intimacy, a greater sense of completion and non-fragmentation. Another definition of dukkha is that sense of feeling like everything is always not complete. That's that sense of incompletion that we feel is another definition of dukkha, that things are not complete. But when we are not looking for the conditioned to be complete or to be perfect or to be more than it actually can be, not its fault, not any of our faults, more than we actually can be, then there is a great sense of relief and intimacy. And this sense of completion is there because it's in our own hearts. It's not based on ourselves or others having to be a certain way. And this is what you could call the unconditioned. You know, a taste or a glimpse or even more living in the unconditioned because of not basing everything, our ultimate happiness, our lasting happiness, on that which is conditioned. And in this, when we move into this for even a moment, let alone in a sustained way, then it's almost like a not-self meeting a not-self, you know, like a Buddha meeting a Buddha, or a not-self meeting a not-self, emptiness meeting emptiness. And in this emptiness, of course, it's not barren, or we're talking about cessation of suffering. It's filled with loving-kindness. Loving-kindness has a chance to emerge and to be seen and to live. Compassion, the attentiveness, the sensitivity to our own suffering and to the suffering of those around us, we can actually be aware of and move to alleviate and have the happiness of moving to alleviate. In its place as well is mudita, or joy, happiness about our own happiness and joy for the happiness of others, as well as equanimity. You know, so in this absence of contraction, it's not just an absence of contraction. It's actually filled with what our hearts truly desire and yearn for. Okay, now I have to get through the path in 2 minutes. I had more to say than I thought. So I'll give you the two-minute version of the fourth noble truth, which is that there is indeed a path. So there's dukkha, there is discontent, there is unsatisfactoriness, there are reasons why, and the reasons why are attachment to agendas and expectations. There is cessation of dukkha, that this is very possible for us, very possible for us, and we practice and the fruit of this truth becomes very real for us. And there is a path of practice that we engage in. And this path of practice involves non-harmful speech and non-harmful action, so ethics, having an ethical foundation in our life. It involves samadhi, or training the heart to be present and fresh and awake and steady, stable and calm. And it also involves wisdom, or panya, meaning learning to look inwardly, learning to turn the attention away from where happiness cannot be found and turning it towards where happiness truly can be found. So looking inside, remembering to look within. Wisdom is waking up and seeing things clearly, not being willing to live in delusion. An aspect of wisdom has to do with not repeating our mistakes. So, you know, in relationship, we all make a million mistakes, and we really have to be willing to make a million mistakes, because if we don't, we're not really engaged. We're actually not engaged enough if mistakes aren't made. And we can learn from our mistakes and not necessarily repeat them over and over and over again. And our heart awakens in the midst of this non-repetition. In practicing in this way, every aspect of life, every person that we are in contact with, we can learn from. You know, everything becomes something we can learn from. Instead of life being a test and feeling that people are testing us all the time and that I am testing myself, we can move into the arena of learning, which is where an enormous continuing richness takes place, and we do discover the awakened heart. So let's sit for just a moment or two.